Listeners to The Book Show might have heard the new editor of the Paris Review, Lauren Stein, speak to me last week about the first edition of the esteemed literary journal in which the work of Australian poet John Tranter featured. Well, the poet himself is currently surfing a marvellous wave of achievement. He's just published a new book of poetry called Starlight, 150 Poems. He's just given all 40 issues of his groundbreaking digital poetry magazine Jacket to the University of Pennsylvania, who have a team of young people working on the next 40 issues. He's just got his Doctor of Creative Arts degree for some of the poems that appear in the new book. Others were written during a residency in Umbria. All this, and John Tranter also used to work at Radio National, starting a program called Books and Writing, which was later taken over by Robert Desay and then by me, which leads us to The Book Show, to now, to this very moment, and John Tranter being here in the studio opposite me. Welcome to The Book Show, John.
Thank you very much, Ramona.
And welcome back to Radio National.
It feels nice to be back here again. It all started in 1975, which seems just like yesterday.
It was just like yesterday. But poetry isn't supposed to be able to deliver this modern-day writer the kind of success you're enjoying. Does that mean that news about the death of poetry and its publishing and criticism has been exaggerated?
I think it has to some extent. I think there's always room for interesting experimental poetry that keeps up with the way things change and develop and grow. I mean, I always feel very much part of day-to-day society, and my poetry is about all of the things around me, so I guess that all takes part in it.
So tell me about the evolution of Jacket, firstly, because I remember you beginning quite a while ago, and you really used the technology of the internet to publish this, you could call it a high-end poetry and criticism venue. I mean, God knows how it was funded. Well, I do know actually how it was funded, because there was that dictum I said, you know, I suppose, you know, you weren't being paid and nobody else was being paid either.
That's right. I started the magazine in 1997 when I went onto the internet to investigate how I could adapt email for the purposes of my wife's literary agency. And while I was there, I looked at the net and thought it certainly has changed in a few years. So I looked at the source code behind a couple of the pages I was looking at, which had colour and imagery and typography for the first time. And I realised I could read the code of HTML because 20 years before I'd learned to operate my wife's typesetting machinery, and that used the same code, believe it or not. And I had worked on a whole lot of literary magazines and poetry magazines over the years. And the main problem with them was that they were very costly to have typeset and printed and distributed, and that it was very hard to get them anywhere in the world outside Australia just because they weighed too much and you couldn't fly to New York and talk a bookshop into stocking them. But I realised the net could maybe get over that problem, and I got together a handful of poems and interviews and reviews that I found from friends or writers I knew and put the first issue on the net in 97 in October. I had no idea whether anyone would ever find it or know it was there. I didn't know how to advertise it. And then I got an email a week later from a fellow who thanked me for including an interview I'd done in 1985 with the British poet Roy Fisher. He said, "I really like Fisher's work and it's hard to find material on him up here in Nome, Alaska."
What a thrill.
And that's when I knew it was going to work. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just looked at Jacket 40 on the net, and so far this issue adds up to 1,254 printed pages.
Yes, that's still too much, isn't it?
No, it's still under construction. But, you know, on what universe could a poetry magazine that was being published in hard copy and sell and printed sell, you know, quarterly printed at 1,254 pages? How much would it cost?
It would cost something like, well, I figured that a literary magazine to run one for a year would cost between $60,000 and $100,000, and that's just to get it up and going. But to do
no,
one
how much would it cost me to buy one for 1,254?
Probably $50
pages.
A copy.
More than that,
or
probably
maybe 100.
Because
yeah.
you wouldn't be able to sell a lot of them, would you?
And how would I get them into New York or London? Most of the readers of Jacket are from North America or from Europe, really. So, it's really solved that basic problem that poetry magazines always had, which was distribution. It's just got over that in one leap. People say the net's wonderful because it lets you do coloured lettering that jumps up and down and so forth. I don't see it like that. Perhaps you can, and I've seen examples that are wonderful to look at. But I just used the net as a way of distributing what was basically a good-looking print magazine as well as I could make it.
There's also no sense you have to appeal to everybody. You can afford to be quite esoteric and, dare I say, difficult sometimes.
Yes, because it's my magazine and I do everything and there's no money involved. I think I can do whatever I like. I mean, one whole issue is devoted to critical articles about the British poet J.H. Prynne. I don't think anyone in their right mind would try to do that with a print magazine. But on the net, you can do anything.
And this is because Australian Literary Management is still supporting the whole enterprise, your wife's literary management?
My wife, Lynn, yes. She and her business keep us alive, basically, and that helps to... She has a web contract with email and a website for her business, and Jacket rides on the back of that. Thank you very much.
And how is the University of Pennsylvania involved now?
Well, I have been doing Jacket now for 13 years, and it does take up a lot of time. I figured at one point around 30 hours a week, so I don't get a lot of time left to write my own poetry or even do the shopping. And I thought it was time to let it go, but I thought if I just stopped it, it would die. There wouldn't be anyone who'd want to preserve it on the net particularly. And there is a website called Pandora at the National Library that very kindly preserves a lot of websites. But I wanted to find a place that would put money and continuing effort into supporting Jacket, and I couldn't think of anywhere except the University of Pennsylvania. I'd done a reading there about 5 years ago at a venue they have on the campus called Kelly Writer's House, which is a very active building. It's just an old one-story building, but they have poetry readings and talks and lectures and discussions right through the week, every week of the year. And I knew they had a very good contemporary poetry course that Bob Perelman had been teaching for 20 years or so. And they also had just started up Penn Sound, which is a huge archive of audio recordings of poetry. So I thought the administration's obviously putting money and time into all of this stuff. If they want Jacket, they'll obviously fit it into all of those other things. Luckily, they said yes, they'd like to have it. So Jacket now has a permanent home with funding, and they have about six staff, I think, working on it, which is nice.
And what's your role with it?
I'm going to stay on as founding editor, which means, I guess, I'm the old guy in the rocking chair on the porch out the back, drinking liquor from an old fruit jar and shouting remarks through the screen door.
And does anyone take any notice of him?
I don't think anyone will, no. They're young people. They've got their own things to do.
And how do you feel about letting go?
Oh, wonderful. It's good to let things go. There was a very interesting essay by Hans Magnus Enzensberger I read about 20 years ago that said how good it was to let things go, how creative and useful. And then the Berlin Wall fell and you could see how right he was, really.
Well, the new collection, Starlight, you wrote the first 94 poems in the new book as part of your recent Doctor of Creative Arts degree from the University of Wollongong, I think.
That's right.
These are more experimental poems. So we'll get those two in a moment. But the other 56 were written during the six-week residency in Umbria in Italy. It sounds gorgeous. And it sounds like in 6 weeks you got 56 poems out.
Actually, in about 4 weeks, because the first week I had a lot of cleaning up to do on a particular issue of Jacket that had to do with the American poet and publisher Jonathan Williams. There were hundreds of graphics that had to be rescaled and resized. That took a week. And the last week, my wife joined me and we drove around Italy and had a good time. So I had really 4 weeks in the middle to write all these poems, which I wanted to do to fill the book out, basically.
Well, they fill out very, very well. I mean, as you say, you wanted to echo, respond to, and sometimes argue with Baudelaire.
Yes.
Tell us about you and Baudelaire.
I'd read Baudelaire when I was very young, as I had Mallarmé and Rambo. I found them all fascinating writers, European writers, particularly French writers from that period, 150 years ago. I went off Baudelaire a bit, I don't quite know why, and fixated on Rambo for many years. And when I came back to look at Baudelaire, it was partly through reading Walter Benjamin's theories about how Baudelaire was an interesting subverter of the contemporary world around him in France, not because he opposed consumerism, but because he was particularly susceptible to it. And he took part in consumerism and explored the city and wrote about it in a very vulnerable way. And that interested me. So I read Le Fleur du Mal again. It's quite a long book, about 150 poems. And I thought, I can update this. And I've done a lot of work like that over the years, where I take a poem by a poet from 100 years ago and wrench it out of its context and dump it down in LA or Melbourne, say, and see what happens to the poem when you do that.
Do you take it from the original French?
I found a website that had the original French and two or three English versions of each poem as well. My French is not that good, so I'd try to read the French and then I'd look at the English and then I'd put all that aside and rewrite the poem as though I was Baudelaire, but I lived here today, that sort of thing.
Well, can we hear one? What about The Duel on page 183?
Okay, yeah, I'm happy to read that. It's a poem I immediately recognised as the sort of poem I might have written 30 years ago myself. It's about the world of poets and poetry, which I guess has been pretty much the same for the last couple of hundred years. This is called The Duel. Two writers savaged each other. Reviews, letters to the editor, then a brawl at a gallery with broken glass and shrieking socialites. Youth, drink, vanity, sexual rivalry. Soon it's teeth and claws and pulling hair. Curses, a skull thudding on the floor, more broken glass, insults, brown-nosing your way into the colour supplements, fraud, failure. In the back alley, haunted by thugs and junkies, our heroes rolled against a garbage bin, punching, the air full of grunts and shouts. This alley is the hell of writers, crowded with ourselves. Fight, gossip, go on. Write it up so our sordid quarrels will become immortal.
Which is self-referential in the poem, I guess.
I can think of half a dozen writers that would fit that poem pretty well.
Yeah. And when we go back to the original Baudelaire, I mean, what was he writing? I mean, what sort of things did you adapt from that?
Well, some of these poems are a long way from Baudelaire. I sort of translate them into contemporary America and so on. But that one I didn't have to do much with at all. I just played with it a bit. But the original was very contemporary in a way.
What about, read us A Present, that's page 184.
That's a lovely little poem, a lighter kind of poem, and it's about poetry really and also personal relationships. It's called A Present. Hey, sweetheart, here's a poem, take it or leave it. One day in the mysterious future, these lines, blown roughly off course, may come to rest in a library to amuse a bored reader for a while. My portrait of you will float above the limping syllables and by the special magic of art, drift in the haze of imagination above the page. Why do I bother? It's hardly your charm. From Paris to Peoria, no one likes you much. Those who know you give you a wide berth. You mock the talented and sneer at the stupid as though God had set you up in judgment. More demon than angel, but utterly lovely.
So these are the ones that you are speaking back to Baudelaire with or talking with him. Tell us, I want you to read one of the ones that you call experimental pieces from the beginning of the book. Number 92, on page 92, Don Juan or Don Juan, D-O-N-W-A-N.
I don't know quite where I got these poems from because they went through so many transformations that the original is lost in time, but I have a theory of trying to find a new way of writing a first draft that's not me so that I can have a fresh voice to start with. And what I did with these poems, there's 101 of them originally and I cut that back to about 80 for this book, is I read poems by Rimbaud, Baudelaire, Verlaine, Mallarmé in French with my Australian accent into a computer that had a speech-to-text recognition program, the sort of thing that executives use to dictate business letters. But the computer only had an English dictionary, so it was trying to make English sense of these Australian-accented French words it heard. And, of course, it created pages of absolute gibberish. And then I reworked them and rewrote them and cut things out and tried to drag them from gibberish towards meaning. How far I got towards meaning, I'm not sure. It was great fun. And then when I'd written 100 of them, 101 of them, I thought I can make this a little bit more interesting, so I went back and put a line of poetry from John Ashbery into each poem, different line in each case. And a lot of the time I've forgotten which was the Ashbery line, but I think I integrated them so much into the poems that they were woven into the woof of the poem.
And these are, if I'm not mistaken sonnets, aren't they?
They're all 14 lines long, and I published a book of 100 sonnets called Crying in Early Infancy many years ago. Reviewers said most of them aren't rhymes, so they're not really sonnets. So I thought I should try and find another name for them. So I've called them, I could call them nonnets, which is non-rhymed sonnets, but there's already a term called nonnets. That's for nine-line sonnets. So I'll have to find another word for them. They're 14 lines long, but they're not rhymed, so they're not really sonnets. And this one's called Don Juan. I guess I was playing on the Don Juan poem by Byron and Don Juan, and I misspelt it deliberately, thinking no one's ever been called Don Juan. And until I read a review of a camera on a website dealing with photography, and the review was signed Don Juan, W-A-N. Very mysterious. But I'd better read it, hadn't I?
Yep.
A glass of champagne for luck and down you go. Under the wave, past the has-been losers and someone called Monty. They are you in the mirror at the end of another weary year. You can't be blamed for giving up when no one comes to dinner, or she's the wrong one, stumbling in through the hothouse full of dying plants, armoured, calm and half alive. The more we feel deeply, the more we resemble the shabby poet Nadir Longley in his long decline, cadging drinks at dusk on the boardwalk. For him, to abandon art would have made nonsense of his long struggle. Thus, there is no answer to the problem of pathos versus experience.
So, that has all kinds of meanings. We can imagine this sort of drunken ending up at the end of the boardwalk. Yeah. And then you have to say, but this was written by a computer.
Well, the initial draft was, and I guess the meaning of the poem's writing occurs between the gibberish of the first draft and the polished thing that I put on the page eventually.
But it's different between the gibberish of the first thought, isn't it? And
yes,
the polished page.
It is. It's like waking up from a crazy dream and you write it down. You think, well, that's too crazy to turn into a poem, but I'll try. And then you work on it and work on it.
So it's the same.
It's like, I've always thought the meaning of poems are like the meaning of dreams. They're intense and deep and mysterious, but maybe someone else can explicate them better than you can anyway. So I've always felt that meaning and poetry, I don't mind if a reader gives a different meaning to the poem they read than I thought was in it in the first place. That's fine with me.
Well, we'll have to wait for the critical response from those people at Jacket.
Yes.
Well, Starlight, 150 Poems, is published by the University of Queensland Press. John Trander, congratulations for all of the good things that are going on in your life.
Thank you very much. It's been a long year and I've enjoyed it. And thanks for having me on the show.
And thanks for joining us on The Book Show. You're on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval.